The Linux Night Tech Show is on. Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open technology, and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Another exciting episode of the Linux Link Tech Show. This is episode 190. My name's Pat Davila. Dan, that's your cue to say your name.
Oh, well, I thought you were gonna say my name too. Dan, somebody else connected in there while the introduction was going on.
Yeah, it's me.
Oh, Alexandro, right?
Alexandro.
Awesome, yeah. Great. Now everybody's here, and we can be a big happy family.
Absolutely, we got really good guests tonight. We got the guys from the Open Office Project. We've got Alexander Colorado, who everyone knows as Jaza from the IRC and the bulletin board. And we've got Luis Suarez Potts. Guys, welcome to the show. It's a big honor having you.
Thanks. This is Luis. And I guess until we get our voices straight, I'll define myself every time I speak. I should point out, by the way, this being Luis, both Alexandra and I come from Mexico, as does Miguel. That's just a side point.
Viva Mexico.
Exactly. And Cinco de Mayo, which really is not that important, is soon to come up.
That's important in America. Well, I mean, the United States.
Now, that's important to the Mexican food chains that are trying to drum up some business.
That's right. And tequila manufacturers.
Exactly.
Exactly. And I live now in Canada, and, you know, finding Mexican food in Canada is nearly impossible, at least edible Mexican food. But I got some chipotle chilies, some dried chipotle chilies, and I was able to use them in dinner tonight, which kind of warmed me a little bit, so that was nice.
Excellent.
Yeah, you should come to visit me here. I'm in Guadalajara. I'm just like a few miles from Tequila, which is actually a town where, well, tequila is made. And we get the tours and look at all the agave, all the plants that make the tequila and all that.
Alexander, you're in Guadalajara now?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. My mom lives in Guadalajara, and I was just visiting her in October. And in fact, we went to various places, and I just tried eating as much. And what I ended up doing, really, eating vast kilos of tortillas, because I found this really great tortillería. And that was a lot of fun. You can't really get good tortillas up here either.
Wow.
I know this is not a discussion, but...
No, that's a Mexican tortilla, which is very different from a Spanish tortilla.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. One is an egg with it on the side, and the other one is a gift of God.
Most Americans are probably more familiar with the Mexican version.
Yeah.
Oh, they should be. I mean, you don't really have Jesus on the face of Spanish tortillas, but you do on Mexican tortillas.
And that makes them all the more tasty, doesn't it?
Right, you know, spiritual.
Because if our Lord Jesus is on there, it tastes damn good.
Okay, so into Open Office. No, we were supposed to say openoffice.org.
Well, what do you guys just say? What exactly you guys do over there? What are your roles in the project?
Alexander, do you want to start?
Sure. My name is Alexandro, like everybody knows, and I'm the co-lead of the Spanish Native Language Project, which basically means that I'll be like handling the community and the website and the mailing list and yada, 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 tons of things related to the Spanish Native language community, which involves all the Spanish-speaking countries. And Luis, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. I'm what's called a community manager, which is a job description that has, or job title description changes per year. And so lately what I've been doing is more on community development and coordinating or trying to coordinate in various ways people who are working on the project. My main focus is not so much in, say, getting more people to use it, although of course that's important, but rather in getting people to develop for it. And so I've been traveling to various places for various conferences, essentially just trying to get companies, governments who are interested in openoffice.org and the file format that it uses, and getting them to start developing for the actual application. I should mention that I've been doing this now for 7 years in one form or another, and my employer, CollabNet, has been hosting openoffice.org for the same period of time, since it started off as a relatively small project. It now has well over 500 or 1,000 registered members, and has been downloaded, probably unique downloads, really hard to gather, but has been downloaded uniquely maybe 50 million times. And we give a number of about 80 to 90 million of the downloads included.
That's cool.
Can you guys just give us a brief history of where the Open Office Project started and where it's evolved to?
I can give a brief one, and then Alexandra can dive in and give some specifics of where it is maybe in Latin America. So it started off in when Sun bought StarDivision in 1999, and the product was called StarOffice, which is still around, by the way. It's now up to version 8 or so, and it's quite good. Sun open-sourced the code to StarOffice in 2000, October 13th, 2000, which is more or less when the project began. And at first, it was a very small group of developers, mainly Sun developers, working on it. And it stayed that way fairly statically until we released. I mean, it was still growing significantly, but it wasn't growing anywhere near the way it is now, until we released the 1.0 version in May of 2002. And then it shot up, and we had thousands and thousands and thousands of people joining the project, and we had people wanting to localize it, better say, translate it, and customize, configure the application into just about every language there is out there. Now we have some like 100 plus languages. So things were really moving extraordinarily in 2002 and 2003 and 2004. And with the release of 2.0, the project and product significantly changed. We have a more professional product now, and people, corporations, governments are a lot more interested in, say, using it as opposed to just a few individuals trying it out and saying, hey, this is cool, look, it's free, and it does everything Microsoft Office does. Now we have governments and we have corporations who are saying, you know, let's mandate that people should use the file format that it uses because it allows for free and proprietary applications to talk to each other without any problems. Let's start seriously thinking about using free software, not because it costs less, but because it gives us flexibility and because we're no longer beholden to Microsoft Office. You know, let's start thinking about using this not because it's just available and the licenses are great, but because it's in our language, and our language happens to be one that there isn't a good application for. So things changed, and we now have a really professional application. We have a huge community. We have millions and millions of downloads, and we also have support, professional support offered by Sun, Novell, other companies, as well as small ones. And we also have a lot of people looking to us and saying, well, you know, you're like the Firefox against IE. You're actually making Microsoft seriously rethink its whole strategy towards the Office market. I mean, Microsoft now is spending a lot of money and is backtracking in many ways and is going through conniption fits trying to keep up with us and not succeeding. Alexander, do you want to talk about Latin American? Or?
Yeah. Well, the Latin America project, and actually the Spanish project in whole, has evolved actually since I first joined the project about 3 years ago now. And, well, actually more, almost four years. And the beginning there was, the user base was the largest one, the power users or the first, the end user, the one that are just coming into the office suite and just asking the random questions. But since then, we actually have incorporated a lot of consultants and people that do open office migrations for larger companies and government organizations. We actually have kind of have specialized a little bit in the migration process and the different schemes on how to move rather larger groups of people to open office in this case, and I'm really glad that we still have a lot of work to do. We will want a little bit more developer base on our native language community, probably one of the best developer communities right now from all the native language projects is probably the French. Which has tons of developers and leaders of developer-driven projects. We kind of want to start doing some mentoring to young developers to start working on the space. But so far, the Spanish native language has come up great.
Well, it's a really fantastic project, and it really has developed quite a bit over the years. I mean, I remember the first release that came out. It was, you know, people kind of looked at it as a Microsoft Office knockoff, and it really has progressed and evolved into something that is way, way more powerful and way more flexible than anything that Microsoft offers.
We like to think so. I mean, you raise an interesting point. A lot of open source projects start off with the idea of just emulating or making free something that is proprietary, and they reverse engineer it. And certainly that's what we did in the format so that we could actually read Microsoft Office documents. And also they try to make it as easy as possible for people who are moving from the proprietary application to the free application. And you saw that with Mozilla initially, and I mean, it was the other way around, of course, in that sense. But with Firefox, I mean, with the idea of tabs and with the idea of extensions that people could add very easily and also create, and with a whole bunch of other things, they really departed from the models of proprietary applications setting the necessary tone, and that's what we're doing now. So we now have extensions, for example. We can save this Shockwave Flash. We can save presentations very easily. We can do a whole bunch of things that Microsoft Office and proprietary applications really can't simply because we're free and people are able to look at the code, configure it, and work on it very easily. So, yeah, I mean, it's great because it was once the case that it was just a knockoff and the alternative, and now it is essentially the future in a sense that there's no real horizons of what it can do.
Yeah, I definitely agree. One of the main features is basically export to PDF documents that have got a lot of business into using OpenOffice, standardizing on OpenOffice. Also, the free nature of the project has make us get into markets where, for example, the language is way too small for the big corporations to actually put money into it. For example, there would be like the Catalonian language, Catalan, is a language used by a very small group of people in compared to, for example, the rest of the European countries or regions. So, for example, for a group right now that is called Soft Catala, they have translated a lot of free software, including OpenOffice. they can easily migrate to this platform as opposed to just waiting on Microsoft to develop a suite that will be translated into language. So this scenario can be repeated many places, especially in Africa and in places where the language users doesn't represent a big market to Microsoft or to the actually commercial companies, not just Microsoft.
I guess when you talk about localization and all the different languages that an application gets translated to, I mean, Microsoft is a huge corporation. Yeah, they have unlimited resources compared to what, you know, the open source world has. You would think they would be able to accommodate most countries, but it seems there is no willingness there to do that. But with, you know, the open source community and free software, the people are willing to do the work if you provide the means for them, and you guys are doing it.
It's yes and no. I mean, it's obviously, as always, more complicated than that. Microsoft, in fact, has been trying to copy us. So, for example, we go to this or that remote section of the world, from my perspective, and we will help set up a localization group or distribution group for open source software, free software. And often these groups are government-funded. So, for example, they are either directly funded, like in Vietnam or Cambodia, or they have indirect funds from the government, or the government will encourage and help set up various organizations that are dedicated to free software or to open source. And at the same time, Microsoft will try copying us and funding its own localization groups. We saw this in India, for example. And also in Wales and elsewhere, where they recognize, and they make all this big splash, they recognize that it's important to win the hearts and minds, to use a war metaphor of sorts, by actually providing these various groups who are interested in using Office software with Microsoft funds. And, you know, arguably this is actually helping them, because you're certainly helping the local economy in a certain way by helping create these jobs, and also by giving the people ultimately an application that runs in their language. But at the same time, it's like saying, let's set up a tobacco farm here, or let's set up a heroin farm or poppy farm. Let's set up something that basically is getting people to work and help produce a local economy and make everyone richer in the local economy, but also creating that situation in which people are ultimately going to be worse off, that is to say, addicted to an organization and addicted to a kind of software that is not really going to be helping them. So free software is different here, but it's not really the case in which people are just always able to perceive that difference, because they're often more likely to look at what's available and what's going to be giving them money in a very short term, whereas free software often requires a long-term perspective. There's no immediate return on a lot of free software. You know, you can get people to work on this in their own leisure, or at their own leisure and in their free time, or even have companies allocating resources to working on free software. But that's not really going to be getting those people very much money, at least in the short term. What will be things like support services, even selling shrink wrap products that have certain enhancements. But that's essentially a few months out at soonest, and probably a couple of years. So there's this complicated dance that we are doing because Microsoft will also do things like lower the price of Windows in China to $3, or I can't remember what it was recently. Really, it's classic strategies. They recognize, they see our primary threat as being free as in beer, not just as in speech. They're trying to diminish the free and sense speech element, say that the primary threat of open source and free software is that you don't have to pay for it, and then are countering by saying, okay, well, we can do the same thing. We can lose billions of dollars for a short period of time. After all, they're doing it with piracy. But look what we gain. We gain all these happy slaves, to put it, you know, in dramatic terms. And the people are often buying into this because, from their perspective, And it's a rational perspective. It's actually sometimes cheaper to just buy into the Microsoft argument and not think about the consequences of doing so. This is unfortunately the case that often free software, open source software, is having to combat against not just piracy, but also the strategies that Microsoft can deploy against us because of its unlimited wealth. So yeah, we can have local groups like you're suggesting who are wanting to work on open source and will work on open source and are delighted to work on open source software, and we're delighted to work with them, but getting that going and keeping it going is actually rather difficult because we have to constantly make them aware and reaffirm to them the dangers of actually not creating a sustainable software economy, but rather just using ultimately something like Microsoft or proprietary software.
One of the really things that seems to be driving adoption of OpenOffice in general is the open document format. I mean, we know that it's not tied specifically to OpenOffice, but OpenOffice is one of the first applications to support it. And it seems this whole initiative where local governments are starting to use ODF is going hand in hand with adoption of OpenOffice. Have you guys seen an increase in adoption through ODF initiative or no?
Yes, and I think that Alexander can probably speak to this in places that he's visited us, and also in Latin America. It's an interesting political question because it goes beyond the merely technological. I mean, open source and free software generally, in the olden days before Stallman himself got the political religion, was a technological thing. The whole idea was that you could create, I mean, it contested certain ideas of how software was made, so you could make software more efficiently by not, say, hiring everybody and having a hierarchical structure, but rather by collaborating intramurally. And open source is all about that, free collaboration. But then you throw in certain political elements here, and the politics come when you actually have to have, when you have a government, quite often a government is involved here, making a choice about how it's going to be spending its money. I mean, then it becomes weirdly enough a political issue because the government has to choose, well, do we buy Microsoft or a proprietary application, or which has proprietary file format, or do we opt for something that has a open standard file format like the open document format and allows us to use any number of applications? Well, logically, the government should choose the latter. I mean, it's like saying, do we buy paper that you need special glasses to read and no one else can read it but those people with those special glasses? Or do you buy paper that's written on plain, that uses pencil or that accepts ink the way regular paper does? No one with half a brain will choose something that is proprietary and that's adding costs, but nevertheless, government, in choosing the more logical and the regular paper, are having to make this only a political point because they're having to allocate and make decisions as to how money is going to be spent. And so that means once you have a process like that, you have everyone coming down to the table and saying, no, you should buy my product. You should continue with the proprietary structure because look at all the goodies that we can give you. So the ODF has allowed us to enter into governments in a way that just merely open source hasn't, because governments were often quite scared of open source. But at the same time, it's also turned it into an interesting political question that has galvanized much of Latin America, and not just Latin America, much of Europe. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. We have seen a huge uptick because of the open document format and because so many applications can use it and because that allows for interoperability among applications. But we've also seen a really fascinating increase in the politicization of essentially software technology.
Right. And actually, I wanted to mention that Open Document right now, actually yesterday was the second anniversary from the Open Document format. And there was a couple of posts on the developer blog sphere of OpenOffice saying basically that, well, arguing if ODF was a disruptive technology. We were mentioning quite in the beginning, the saying like OpenOffice was seen as an alternative to Microsoft Office with their kind of clone-like interface for Microsoft Office. However, with the open document format, we got to the table first, way before Microsoft, and we were able to implement it rather more steadily than Microsoft binary, well, actually XML formats, which come until Office 2007, which is the docx and the XML schemes for the MS, what they call the open XML, which they did in pretty much in purpose to make the scene more confusing. We got an XML standard format established in the European Union thanks to this study called, I forgot the name. Do you remember the name, Luis? The study from the EU?
No, I can't offhand recall the name.
All right. Well, basically the future was moving from binary office document formats to XML.
You mean the XML thing?
Yeah. And after this study, basically one of the standards that were competing back then, that was a couple of years ago, was the OpenOffice format, which is the one that we knew in OpenOffice 1.x, which is the SXC, and the other ones. And they were XML, but they were very, they were made proprietary in the sense that they were, the schema of the XML was referring back to, in this case, Star Office, starting with the SXW, which means Star Executable Writer. That was the name of the extension. And then we migrate to to the ODF format, which the scheme presents a more neutral or private to the open document format in itself. So this was one of the requisites for the EU to actually ratify the open documents, and then it got expanded and spread throughout the other standardization bodies. In this case, was OASIS the first one, which is kind of like a W3C, but for XML type format. And then it moved to the ISO, which is the International Standard Organization. And we got ISO qualification about almost a year ago. So getting all these, let's say, titles or verifications gave us basically were able to put us in the table way before the other formats, including the docx, which was not really well developed until Office 2007. And we actually gained more market and more and captured more eyes. And well, we've seen a lot, like going back to the government, what the way they're doing it. There was a very controversial piece on this Florida movement to open documents and the so-called Men in Black, meaning the lawyers from Microsoft coming down to block the initiative. Then again, we've seen also bills in the United States, in the state of Texas and California moving forward. And also the very controversial last year was the one in Massachusetts. But even though I used to work in a government for a really, really, really small time, and we usually see the government as pretty much the same way we see Microsoft, as this big monolithic block that moves some kind of slow, but really what it's made of is of these different groups within side of them that they keep eating each other, basically on a dog-eat-dog battle for who get the most money. So usually you might think, well, it's logical for the government to save money. However, one study inside of it, you will say you actually need to spend that money, because otherwise if you save it, next year you might not get the same amount of money. And also there are people getting kickbacks from all these deals. So it's rather complicated. It gets political. And then, for example, we saw the act of implementing open document get blocked in Massachusetts by a group arguably funded by Microsoft, which I guess I cannot say for sure. But it was based on the push for accessibility for the blind and handicapped people. So there was a group formed, and they basically lobby against implementing open documents. As these things are going through the United States mainly, there are very successful cases going all over the world where open documents is making inroads. One of the studies was in education. In the UK, this organization called Vectra has successfully ratified open documents, and is actually moving forward on implementing open source across the board, including the open document format. So we're seeing that we get a lot of wins also from these movements. So far in Latin America, the adoption has been mainly on the southern cone of the continent. Argentina and Chile, they basically being more open to accept this format. And also the controversial governments like the Venezuelan government that is moving to open source. Actually, I want to make a plug. Last weekend, there was a Free Soul movement, which basically is an install fest done across Latin America, all in the same day. And we have, there were basically 250 sites across the continent, each one gathering from 150 people to 2,000 people, moving to open source and getting open office in their boxes, in their laptops, and in their desktops. And the Ecuadorian government, they got the president of the Ecuador talking about free software and inviting people to start adopting free software, since they're very firm in implementing free software across the government, which will drive also the use of open standards, in this case open documents. So it's basically kind of like a Cold War right now. Who gets the open documents and who gets with the open XML? And we're trying to get into different regions adopting it. It's like a race.
Have you guys heard about the stories of Microsoft sending out a team of lawyers to all the different states within the United States to combat legislation in each state's particular legislator? They're pushing ODF, where they go in and they, you know, I guess persuade is the word to use, people within the government not to switch over to ODF. Are you guys aware of this?
That's what Alexandra referred to in Florida. There was a report in NewsForge that Robin Miller posted a couple of weeks ago, or last week, I can't recall now, where you, in fact, did have legislators had initially proposed a bill to mandate open standards for office documents. And I'm not sure, I can't recall if they specified ODF. Often they don't. Often they just hint very strongly that ODF, or frame it so that ODF is the only one that can meet the requirements. And then Microsoft's lobbyists, as Robin Miller called them, men in black, essentially persuaded, to quotation marks, to consider other options, shall we say. And so, yeah, I mean, Microsoft is fighting this battle because they see it as, they rightfully should see it as, really very crucial to their longevity in every way possible. They are working with to counter the community by setting up bogus community localization groups or bogus community groups, that is a group that are really going to be helping Microsoft, not helping the community. They are battling on the legislative ground, the front. They're lowering their price whenever possible. They're trying to emulate what free software does naturally without really being free. So their emulations, if they are not free. So it ultimately is all to help Microsoft's bottom line, but to the average person, it may not be obviously that. Fortunately, I mean, as Alexandra pointed out, you do have, and this is one of the, this is why I brought in the politicization of it so quickly, is that you do actually have far-seeing leaders who are mandating open document format or open standards and quite often open source, because they see the importance of having free software in their region. And they're not saying, like, you must use it. They're saying, like, you know, software should be, open source software should be considered. They're not forcing people to use it. No one's forcing anyone. They're rather saying, you know, let us open the doors to investigating the use of free software. I mean, Cuba went through a similar point because they said, you know, we're spending all this money on proprietary software. Let us consider the possibility of using free software to meet our needs. And this is what we're seeing everywhere, not just in Latin America, not just even in Europe, but in China and in Africa and Australia very recently. People are considering the possibility of using free software and are often pending their decisions or predicating their decisions on open standards. Even though an open standard can work with proprietary software, it's often easier to consider the options when you're discussing an open standard because it can work with proprietary applications. But the goal for a lot of regions is to focus attention on open source software, free software, because it liberates you from the license obligations that proprietary software comes with.
Trevor in the IRC has a question. He was interested to know what you guys think about the free Microsoft Office ODF plugins, the Microsoft-sponsored CoverAge, the Sun plugin, and the DaVinci Acme plugin.
I'll go very briefly, and then Alexandra can dive in, I guess. I have mixed feelings, the way everyone does, I think, about it. I would much rather that people use OpenOffice.org than use a plugin, because from my perspective, using a plugin is essentially, to use a metaphor that I've used before, is essentially giving a transfusion to a vampire. You know, why not try the steak through his heart? But the reason why people, or why governments are requiring the plugin and why it's not a bad thing at all, why you need to give a little trickle of blood, is because in the case of, say, Massachusetts and other government groups, they may require applications that have not been configured yet or built for free software. So the disability movement or people, I mean, various other tools that are associated with that require Microsoft Office. It's not that Microsoft Office is a better fit for the disabled or for those who are blind or have other difficulties. It's rather the case that the plugins have been created for Microsoft Office. And the companies can't very easily, although they're moving in the direction of building now for free software, they can't just turn on a dime. So the government might mandate using ODF or the open document format. Massachusetts and others are going in that direction. But until there is a application or plugin that allows those who are blind to use OpenOffice as easily as they use Microsoft Office, then a plugin is going to be required there. And this is true with other government entities. Now, I think that we are working very hard, because we're working very hard on meeting the demands of everyone who currently must use Microsoft Office, that this won't be such an issue any longer. But until that is really finalized, a plugin makes sense. And it also makes sense in cases where you have a massive migration, like hundreds of thousands of seats, and need to do it gradually, but are still requiring everyone to use open document format because that makes it easier for others. So a plugin's not bad, it's just not the best solution. It is, from my perspective, a stopgap solution.
Well, I got a question there. So you seem to not be have a negative slant towards a plugin. Now, what if they just bit the bullet and offered native support for ODF? How does What's your opinion on that? Or it probably wouldn't change how you feel about Office, but do you think that would impact on the adoption of OpenOffice?
I should add one thing about the... I'll get to your question in a second. About the plugins. The way everyone's talking about the plugins as if, you know, they really work. There are mixed reviews on that. And although I haven't actually tested the plugins myself because I have yet to go and buy Office 2007. For some clear reason, I just haven't done it. I guess it doesn't work on a Macintosh or Linux or anything like that. But anyway, so I don't really know how well these plugins work. So they could actually just be pure crap. But nevertheless, they have the rhetorical appeal of somehow working. So anyway, that said, if Microsoft Office were to offer complete support for ODF, that'd be great for Microsoft. They would probably be doing better than they are now. They'd be a lot more relevant. My feelings towards Microsoft have not changed one iota because I see the open document format as being incredibly important because I think that open standards are really required going forward. I think that the idea of having only proprietary standards or standards that are very close to proprietary despite claiming to be open, like the OpenXML, which is insanely complicated and very difficult to implement, as being bad. I think that having a simple or having a sophisticated and simple open standard is really required here because we need to preserve our digital documents and we need to be able to communicate with others who, regardless of the application they're using. If Microsoft were to implement the open document format, that'd be great for Microsoft. Would it change my views and would it change most free software advocates' views about Microsoft? No, because they are still a monopoly and they are still proprietary software. I think the key point here is that you want software that isn't only able to be used, and but also by lots of people without having to spend essentially a year's income, which is what it would cost to buy Microsoft Office if you live in Thailand and were buying it at a regular price, but rather software that can be configured, some software that can be adjusted to your own needs. Venezuela, Cuba, Peru, and all the other countries in Latin America, and many of the European countries are not saying, you know, let's use software that is going to further put us into the situation of, you know, at some point beholden to the monopoly. They're saying, let us use software that gives us freedom not only to configure, but also to think about using other software. So if Microsoft were to implement ODF, that'd be great, but that doesn't mean you should use it. It just means that you should actually use OpenOffice more so that you don't have the problem then really of actually having to worry at all about, say, interoperability or anything like that. So it'd be great for Microsoft, but would it be good for its bottom line?
Seriously, why would they want to do that? It would just hasten their end.
That's one way of putting it. And I think that a lot of people, it's kind of interesting, a lot of people just have been feeling that Microsoft already is clutching at straws. But then, you know, you look at how much they made last year, and you look at their claims for Vista sales, and you look at what they reported to the SEC, and I doubt if they're all lies. So they are still formidably powerful. They still have amazing momentum, and they're still obviously the dominant topic of conversation at the show, supposedly about free software.
At the very least, though, they would be on equal footing, at least from a technical perspective. If there was file interoperability, where there were no barriers, you know, exchanging files between applications and platforms, then they really would have to create a better product to compete.
That's the desire, yeah. And better in what sense? I mean, we have different standards now as to what better means. It used to be better meant more features. Better means now able to work with other products. Better means now being lighter. Better means be able to add extensions at will. Better means able to create collaborative environments. Better means able to, you know, work with products that we like a lot, namely web browsers. Better means to do all sorts of exciting things. Better doesn't mean being beholden to a feature-intense client company.
Well, most people don't use 10% of what these applications can do, to be honest.
Yeah, one thing that I've been watching the chat room right now, there's a lot of questions going on about, well, all these, the new Office 2007, the Ribbon UI implementation, and many other things. It's clear that Microsoft changed his route in the recent version of Office 2007, changing dramatically the user interface. And basically, it's a gamble, but it's true that they are trying to transform themselves. And I think one thing that OpenOffice is doing right now at the moment is also trying to follow suit on the way of competing on technical basis. One of the going back to Open Documents a little bit, one of the promises of Open Documents is the same promises of XML, which is basically transform your data and be able to migrate from one platform to the next and to one application to the next one without any significant barrier. I think what the ODF plugin is doing is basically giving that example to come into life when you can migrate from one application to the other to a web browser to, in this case, would be with these new Ajax applications. It would be a matter of time before there's an open source word processing application, web application, which you can basically send your data from your OpenOffice application to the web application, in this case Google Documents and Google Spreadsheets, which actually were before small independent companies like Writely and Iro, before they got acquired by Google. They basically implement the open document compatibility within a week. And I know that because I emailed the guys when they just came out, and I just say, hey guys, can you please implement open documents? Here's some of the work we have done on converting open documents to HTML using XSLP and other technologies, and they just pick it up, and within a week or 2 weeks, they have it completely implemented. So this basically proves what the technical merits of having an open standard file format and would enable you to do is to pass that information from one application to the next. And how does that leave OpenOffice? Because you have you mentioned a little bit like, well, if Microsoft supports Open Documents, wouldn't be that a barrier for adoption for OpenOffice? And I think the answer is no. Well, basically, what are you enabling there from a company perspective is that you can save, if you not completely migrate, you can have these hybrid companies where the end user that don't have any need for these really sophisticated plugins that connects to a backend and provide certain functionality that is very vertical integrated. You can have, for example, secretaries or end users that don't have that need migrate to OpenOffice and effectively exchange the documents between the open with the upstream, with the more technically demanding population within your company. So from a company perspective, I think the ODF makes a lot of sense. As long as the data is there and it's not lost, I think it's a good thing for basically to diversify their technology. Also, there's a lot of companies that are not changing, are not migrating to the latest and greatest. They're not switching to Vista, are not switching to Office 2007. They're still running Windows 98 with an old version of Office, and basically they don't have that need to provide that interface. And I think that that OpenOffice is great for these companies because they can stabilize their whole infrastructure within an open application infrastructure.
Yeah, I just want to add something to Alexandra said. Yeah, it's completely true. And it's one thing that we've noted for the last couple of years is that OpenOffice.org, because it works so well with Microsoft Office, and will work well with OpenOffice, with OXML, I mean, Office 2007, does allow for the hybridization of the Office space. And in fact, that's a whole goal, really, of having an open standard. And it's also a characteristic of OpenOffice.org's technology itself, because merely having an open standard doesn't allow you necessarily to work with proprietary standards like DOC. So, by Microsoft's binary formats. So, yeah, having the hybrid office is terrific. And we're also not requiring people, no one ever requires anyone, to move if they don't want to something like OpenOffice.org. They can stick with Microsoft Office if they like those particular features that it offers. And it has some features that people like a lot. And we have some features that people like too. So there's no need necessarily to move to only one application. This is the whole point. This is the virtue of having a free space and free office, is that you can have hybrid situations like that.
Yeah, one thing that we really need to move forward, and I'm not speaking, the problem with OpenOffice and Open Documents is that there's a lot of overlap between each other sometimes, and the communities usually have the same members. So arguing on behalf of Open Documents, one of the promises is basically trying to put your documents in cell phones, in small devices, basically increase the portability of these documents. And we're just basically striving to get more developers involved in supporting Open Documents on the frameworks. For example, last week I was reviewing all these Open Document libraries, which are on the PHP sphere. There's three main libraries being developed at the moment, basically to what would be, for example, the PDF lib, which is a PHP library to easily generate PDF from HTML. Basically, they're trying to do the same thing, but to generate Open Documents from HTML. And I think there's a lot of potential, but we really need to bring those people together and make them able to concentrate the development and just improve the one library in itself, and not having these three different libraries which go through three different APIs of XML parsing to basically just triplicate the effort. That's one thing that we're really working on in the open document space. Now in the open office space, we're dealing with what is coming with the extensions, the extendability of open office. Open office has grown way too much, and complexity in the application has also has basically put a couple levels up on trying to break into the code and trying to improve it. Now, having extensions will open just a new way to develop the extensibility of the application itself. So, for example, just like Firefox, you have these libraries of extensions and enable you to enhance the application on your demand, not on what Mozilla.org says, because you have third-party extensions. You also have in OpenOffice will enable you to have a whole sphere or development sphere of these extensions to enable you to have better use of the OpenOffice application. And OpenOffice is very powerful. It supports a broad language sphere. It supports JavaScript, supports Python, supports Java and C++, as well as you're creating bindings for other development environments like Rex and Rex, I forgot. But basically what I'm saying is that it will break down the barrier to break into the development of OpenOffice. You will have developers learning easy languages or just they already know the easy language and trying to grasp on the API, which is still very hard for most developers. We're working on simplifying that and just make the OpenOffice experience better for their users. And also it creates a market, because there will be more appeal for companies to start implementing their own solutions to connect into a backend, for example.
Just a second, what Alexander said, our extensions project, which is still relatively young, offers ultimately, and pretty soon really, the ease of writing extensions as people can now for Firefox. And essentially you can just use JavaScript, Java, any kind of scripting language. to link one application that does something to openoffice.org and then make it available to the community freely. So this is essentially the promise, and yeah, it's going to be expanding the way that people are looking at openoffice.org and what they can be doing with openoffice.org. We're also working on something called the ODF Toolkit. It's a new project, and the ultimate goal is to make available the ODF generating capability of openoffice.org for any application, which is fairly exciting because it disentangles detangles the code so that you can then apply this to, say, mail client, a spreadsheet client, or whatever you want to call, to save those files as ODF files and allow them then to communicate freely with each other, with other applications that have this capability, and also with openoffice.org or with applications that are able to read and write ODF, which expands the universe, which expands the developer base, which expands the whole ecosystem. I mean, you have to think about it, but right now there's a relatively limited number of developers who are able to work on openoffice.org, but we see that changing because of extensions, because of the ODF toolkit, because of the sheer number of users in the very near future.
One of the questions that came through the IRC a little while ago was about the adoption of document format and OpenOffice in Massachusetts, and they were curious as to how that's progressing.
So am I. The last I heard was that it is progressing. It's, I don't think, going to be implemented for a short while. And I think the easiest way to answer the question, the way that I would answer it, is just do a Google search or do Wikipedia Open Document Format Massachusetts and get the right answer. I haven't kept track of it since Andy Up the Grove updated people probably last year or earlier this year. And from what I heard, it was still on track. It has not been derailed, and it probably will come out. There's a lot of big corporate interest in getting this done. And I very much doubt that Microsoft is going to see it undone. So I'm pretty sure that Wikipedia has been tracking it more effectively than I could track it right now. So that's generally probably the best answer.
Yeah, Groglo has come behind that, those topics, actually. Groglo has a huge repository of information upon the open documents versus open XML. And I put the link on the chat room for the listeners right now. But basically, there are a couple of good sites out there that will give a lot of information regarding the current status of open documents across the world, not just Massachusetts.
Well, anyway, just check the Massachusetts, and you probably have the link. It's essentially, the search I use is opendocument_adoption_Massachusetts. And it just says exactly what's going on here until the very end. So it's, as far as I know, it's still going on. And the interesting thing about Massachusetts that Alexandra and I can speak to is that it clarified, and this is the question that was asked about half an hour ago, that it clarified the way in which open source applications like OpenOffice.org can approach governments, whether they're state, city, or federal, and that is by focusing on the standard, not just on open source itself. And that was taken, I mean, it was a revelatory moment, and has been taken very seriously by all the adherents of open source. But especially OpenOffice.org, because when we were just approaching it from the open source perspective, yes, a lot of people were embracing open source, but a lot of them were also saying, well, where's our support? What about liability? What about training? What about all these other things? Because they're very used to dealing with a single point vendor, let's say one vendor who offered not only the application, but how to use it. And open source changes that. You are dealing rather quite often with a community. You're dealing with a bunch of people. you're dealing with an unfocused group that may have support, but it may not be certified support. It may have training, but it may not be certified. It may not even have training. So focusing on the ODF, on the open standard, really changed things and allowed us to penetrate or to enter into discussions with governments much more easily. And it was because of Massachusetts.
Well, hopefully other states wise up to it and adopt, you know, the open document format as well as other open source and free software. It's a good thing, you know. And hopefully, you know, politicians have the insight to at least give it a chance.
They are. And California has, and many other states have it on their legislative agenda to consider it and to move in that direction. Europe is decidedly moving in that direction. In fact, the European government has. And this is true of almost every developed nation and many of the developing nations. They are actually seriously considering mandating it for government usage. There will be considerable counter efforts, and sometimes they will succeed, but the overall battle will probably be won by open standards such as ODF and not such as unimplementable OOXML. See, the difference between ODF and why it's so easy, as Alexandra pointed out, for a group to implement it, and why it's not easy for OOXML or Microsoft's XML to be implemented, is the difference in size. ODF is about 600 pages long in its description. Microsoft's Office file format, which ECMA, the European Standardization Body, approved, is well over 6,000 pages. And ODF is a little bit more general in the way it specifies things. The OOXML, as it's called nowadays, is incredibly detailed in how it specifies things. So in order really to implement the OOXML with 100% faithfulness, you essentially have to reverse engineer or rebuild Microsoft Office 2007. In order to implement the ODF, you need not do that at all. You just have to essentially create an application that can do save files in the format that is described there. And it's relatively easy to do because you can also read it and you can actually do it without going crazy or without spending vast amounts of time. Now, as a blog, people have pointed out, cute name blog people, but anyway, as bloggers have pointed out, you don't have to implement every element of the Microsoft schema or the ODF, but you do have to implement a substantial portion if you want it to look like what, if you want it to read accurately what the original document was, so it's actually a meaningful implementation. And you do have to read the 6,000 plus pages, and you do have to understand exactly how these things are working. And that's a lot more difficult than working with the ODF. The ODF right now, we have, I lost count, again, Wikipedia is my friend here, but we have seven or so implementations right now, at least, and a lot more coming down. I mean, just think, for example, of the Korean, Japanese, and Chinese applications that will soon be implementing ODF. With Microsoft Office file format for 2007, there's so far only one implementation, and that's Microsoft Office 2007. And it has been available as an open, as a so-called open standard for a while now. So there could have been implementations, but there are not.
One of the questions coming in from the IRC is, what's your opinion of what the KDE group is doing with KOffice and comparing that with OpenOffice?
I love KOffice. I love the KDE group. I think that they are doing fantastic work. I wish that we were collaborating more strongly, and every time we see each other, we have, you know, bear hugs and greet each other warmly and friendly. And say, let's collaborate. It's kind of like saying, let's have lunch. No, seriously, I think they're doing fantastic work, and I just wish them the best of luck and think that they're doing really super stuff for the areas that OpenOffice.org really can't enter into too easily. For example, they're lighter than we are. The architecture is different, and they can go on different applications more easily. So smaller applications. So, you know, like the one laptop per child, I think, was considering K-Office at one point. I'm not sure what they ended up with. OpenOffice.org was too resource-intensive for them. So they're doing really tremendously great work, and the fact that they're saving files or using files as ODF as their default format is really fantastic. Now, it'd be even better if we and they were, in fact, collaborating more so that the technology that we've created and technology they have created could more easily be utilized by each project. But unfortunately, for several reasons, that's been difficult to actually do. But one can hope, and the hope would be that, in fact, there's more collaboration between us or among us, and that would include ABI Word as well, because there's every reason to have multiplicity of different applications, because just as I mentioned here, some applications work better in some environments than others. But there's no reason, really, why we can't also share code if a license is permitted and if the basic technologies permit it. And so the hope is that at some point they will permit it.
Right. I have good experience also using K-Office. One of the things is that they, for example, can import, not just export PDF, so you basically will have a PDF and open it in K-Office, make some changes and save it as PDF also. So that right there is a very good functionality that actually we have a lot of our users asking for us to implement it. So I think that we have our own advantages, and we can learn from each other and hopefully improve each other. There's also other office suites like AbbeyWord and Gnumerics. We hope that Gnumerics guys would get on board on adopting Open Document Format, but there's also the big, Open Document Format is an open standard, and we'll be continuing getting developed. And one of the areas that we are actually working actively in implementing is the specification for formulas and MathML, which is what we use within our. But you have to realize Open Documents is really a group of open standards. It's not just one open standard. We actually have open standards from different areas. We have some components of SVG, for example, in our Open Draw program. And we have the Dublin Core, which is a meta tag standard within our meta tag system. And we have XML Secure, which is also an open standard on security on XML within our encryption environment to create password generated digital firms or digital signatures and encrypt our documents. So when you talk about open documents, you're talking about all these open standards that are really wrapped around the open document umbrella. So it does make sense for all these software applications that are open source to adopt open documents, not just because you will say, well, it's an open office technology. No, it's actually an open standard groupware or suite that you're adopting. And you're making your application survive. You're pretty much securing that it will survive the development in the future. So I think it's a great opportunity for all these other office suites, and we need them. We actually do need a smaller, like a web-aware office suite or a web-enabled, Web 2.0 office suite and a mobile office suite and a KDE a KDE better integrated office suite and a GNOME one, and I guess that and the side of open source development, I think there's a bright future. Also, there are commercial developments being done from other companies that they usually pop in and pop out, and I actually don't remember so much of the names. I know, for example, NeoOffice, which is open source, as far as I know, have a better installation or an easier installation process on OS X because it doesn't rely on X11 to be installed. And there's also more localization-specific offices like the Chinese one with Red Office, which takes pretty much takes the OpenOffice core. So I think we do the development, not just from Open Documents, but the actual Open Office API is growing and is getting diversified by the minute.
And this is the strength and beauty of open source.
It's good things. One of my favorite features of OpenOffice is the export to PDF. I think that feature alone is worth its weight in gold.
Wait until you get presentations and find that you really, really need that. because often, you know, you move. If I use Macintosh and I travel all over the place, and often I'm giving presentations and my Macintosh just won't work perfectly with the setup that they have because it's all set up for Windows, and it'll work nearly perfectly, but not perfectly. But if I save it as a PDF, it works beautifully. Or if I save it as a Flash movie, it works even better.
Yeah, there's a cool extension that you can download right now. And you can actually, when you save your documents, it will save it on all three different formats. So you will have PDF, Open Documents, and Microsoft format, all saving one click. So that's a pretty neat idea of an extension, for example.
That's pretty cool. Actually, thanks for telling me. I'll download it because otherwise I've been just saving it tediously one at a time.
Yeah.
That sounds like a time saver. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, right now I'm actually being interested in the Python development because Python is such an easy language to learn and to master, and actually having Python framework being more used in the OpenOffice development sphere, you can actually enhance OpenOffice quicker and actually bind it to all these different modules that Python usually have right now. So from a development perspective, I think extensions would be greatly benefit from the use of this, what it called PyUno, which is Uno is the actual core API of OpenOffice, and having PyUno better understood by the development community will actually make the OpenOffice suite more flexible.
Well, another interesting thing that I find is that if you receive a Word document from one of the Windows users that you deal with, you take that file, you convert it to an Open Document format, and then you convert it back to a doc file format, the file actually shrinks down in size, which is very interesting. It seems the footprint has gotten smaller going through OpenOffice.
Yes, and if you actually look at the document, it's basically a zip file, a general zip file with a bunch of XML documents in itself. So it's pretty, that's actually the advantage of using OpenOffice. Actually, if you see OpenOffice, it's like you will save a web page that have different images. So if you don't want to save this web page and all of a sudden have 100 images because the page come to have 100 images in it, it will just create a zip file with all those images inside of it. That's basically Open Documents. So you will, instead of having HTML code, you will have the XML code, and instead of having the actual images would be within a scheme or a specification of the Open Document. So it's really, like I said, easy to develop and easy to port. XML advantage is that it's not just machine readable like the binaries, but it's also human readable. I mean, it's not going to be pretty formatted, but if you open an XML in ASCII or any in VI or any text editor, you will actually be able to see the information that you have. So even if you don't have an OpenOffice, you could read what the content of the document used to have or was meant to have. So I think that's a great idea. One thing I want to comment, though, because we're going on and on, and I really want to touch this area, is the OpenOffice community. I think that one of the most important parts of all the open source projects, the most successful open source projects, is the community in it. And as opposed to many open source communities, the OpenOffice community is very
diverse in the sense that we don't just have developers and hardcore C++ programmers with a lot of time development and very little time to socialize. We also have people that are out there, people that love, for example, marketing and advocacy and technologists that will get on stage and have a speech on 100 people on the auditorium and then be able to talk to kids and be able to talk to grown-ups about Open Documents. It's really a very diverse community, and I think that's one of the advantages that we have, and it could actually make better synergy with the actual features of that, or the technical features of OpenOffice. One thing that we see a lot is that a lot of people have they want to have more support. However, our support mailing list, which is one of our veins of giving support to people, is not very visible for the end user. So the end user will get OpenOffice in a CD, and he wouldn't know, or he would actually have to figure out that there is a website, and figure out that there is a community, and figure out that there is a mailing list somewhere, and figure out they actually have to subscribe. One of the things I actually want to, that I'm working at with other people is to implement the support of the community within the OpenOffice suite, which is something that I've been working, we're debating back and forth how we can do this and whatnot. But I think it's a great idea if we can actually bring the community as a feature to the software and actually make a bridge between them. And also it's a very good way to gather more people. I mean, we are huge, but then again, we also need a lot of people. It doesn't require a lot of technical knowledge to support this community or to engage this community on different areas. We have a very healthy art community, for example, that all they do is basically create images for either our website or our different marketing events, for example. So you might just know GIMP, or you might just know Photoshop, Flash or something, and be able to contribute to OpenOffice, and you don't really need to know all that development to actually be a very functional element within the community.
I totally agree with Alexandra, and just add one point. We actually don't distribute any CDs. It's always third parties that are distributing them. And it'd be great if they worked with us in actually putting in links to the web page and normalizing it, and we've asked them to. But until that happens and they agree to include in the ISO image that we do distribute, all those things that Alexandra mentioned, it's not likely. And with downloads, I mean, I think we really do promote and need to promote more, though, the support options, because there are actually quite a lot of companies that are offering support for OpenOffice.org. This is not just a community, if you want to call it, they're part of the community, but many of them are offering for fee support, and they range throughout the world, and they include small companies like mom and pop's offerings, or just one person offering support, to small and medium-sized businesses, to major enterprises. So, yeah, I mean, people have to be aware that there's support, and they also have to be aware that there's a community, because the thing that characterizes open source versus proprietary software is that anyone who is using it has the potential to become a producer and transcend the consumer status that the person's been plunked into. And making that easier, and OpenOffice.org really does make it pretty easy, because if Alexandra pointed out, you know, we have an art community, we have marketing, we have any number of things people who have no technical ability can join and start helping out with. Making that whole process to become a producer easier, it's really unique to OpenOffice.org, and it's one of the characteristics that I think make us so special to so many people. I have to be running off. There's a lot of things I have to do, because I'm giving a presentation in Montreal on Friday. And I have to write that presentation. It's on the Open Document format, and it's at Libre Graphics. event, which should be pretty interesting. I do have to get work. And if you have any last questions, I'll hang around for that, but then I have to go away and do work.
Well, I thank you for your time. I mean, it's been really great. I do have one question for both of you. And speaking about open office and producers and people packaging it, is there a concern about fragmentation or feature creep? Because I know that Novell is putting some efforts into interoperability between Microsoft Office and Open Office, and will probably be implementing different things. Is there a concern that what they implement in their distribution of Linux with Open Office could end up being different than what, say, Ubuntu does, or, you know, the standard Open Office packages?
Yes. Novell has been very good about making sure that whatever changes they put into their packages come down to the main repository of OpenOffice.org that is maintained by Sun and the OpenOffice.org community. And so I have no doubt that Novell would make every effort to continue in that practice. But the main thing that would allow for this divergence, call them forks, I mean, if you want to call spade a spade, is if it's seen in the interest of the various companies to go their separate ways and to continue with the fragmentation versus, say, continue building up the actual repository. So we have several things that have to be clear. One, it's always better for, or put it this way, it's usually better for an open source project to have a primary or single repository to which people are contributing the code ultimately, and that is defining effectively the actual identity of the product or the source. Second, having trademark actually does help. I mean, there was a recent blog by Mark Shuttleworth on Ubuntu's trademark, and OpenOffice.org has been discussing similar trademark policy. We have rather weak policy right now. It's very much laissez-faire, but I'm actually personally, and want to persuade everyone, in favor of a stricter policy along the lines of Mozilla. Now, there are a lot of counter-arguments to this. One, Mozilla went through essentially fire bath when it came out with this trademark policy, and Debian had some interesting comments to that effect. And you don't necessarily want to go through something like that. But on the other hand, there are numerous large and very small possibilities of forking. And I'd rather come to an agreement, if we do come up with a trademark like Mozilla's, first with all the distributors as to what they are actually distributing and what actually makes up OpenOffice.org, and lay out some rules that everyone can follow so that we can agree on where exactly we're standing and where to go forward. It's not a crucial pressing issue right now, but it is, as you know, Mark pointed out in his own Ubuntu column, it is an issue that the second you reach a certain size becomes actually quite important, and OpenOffice.org has reached that size, and I'd rather make sure that there's minimum fragmentation and that there is maximum coordination with the with everyone so that we have a single identity or a meaningful identity when people, so that people, when they get OpenOffice.org, know what they're getting. And if there are emendations or changes or alterations of some sort or another, enhancements, we call them, it can be clarified as to what they are. So it can be like OpenOffice.org plus whatever, or based on OpenOffice.org. So I am concerned by that point. I have every faith and believe that Novell, for example, will in fact make changes or put changes back into the community. But I'd also like to have an agreement with Novell and other distributors as to what counts as OpenOffice.org.
Cool. I thank you, Lewis, for coming on tonight. I wish you best of luck with your presentation.
Thanks, and thanks, Alessandro, and thanks, Dan, and thanks to everyone, and I would look forward to at one point hearing this.
Yes, it should be. It'll be up tonight.
Okay.
It'll be up tonight.
Thanks, folks.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Hi. Hi, Luis.
Alessandro.
Hey,
now the grilling starts.
Yes. let's, you know what? Alessandro, you are everywhere. I see you.
Yes.
And let's, if you don't mind, could we get a little glimpse into the life of Alexandro? Who is Alexandro? And, you know, what do you do and why are you everywhere?
I ask that myself usually. I usually try to be, get miles. I get miles, or just get the first opportunity to get off the country and move somewhere else and get girlfriends in Eastern Europe and stuff. So, yeah. And also, I usually have spent a lot of time listening to podcasts.
Because I've heard you on, let me think now, I've heard you on Jack Attack, Linux Reality, and I also think, I think you emailed the guys from the Linux Action Show, too.
And I'm very shy about it. I don't email as much as I actually once thought that I would. For me, I listen to a lot of the technology podcasts. But for example, I don't like getting into talk show because it's quirky and stuff. Otherwise, I will be in 10 different more podcasts. But anyway, I don't have a knife. Yeah. No, it's pretty cool. Basically, I just want to be more. I know I actually had a podcast at one point, and I know what it feels like streaming to do nothing and not getting any feedback, not getting many listeners, something that you guys never faced.
We did in the beginning.
So I actually want to provide feedback and actually help. I think we need a lot of more Linux podcasts out there. And not saying that they should just stop listening to the Linux Link Tech Show, but I'm just saying that I think that the podcast is a great way to build awareness of what's going on in open source. And just basically giving that feedback will secure me listening or maintaining this podcast alive. I think I as a listener, the one that becoming a reality has to be something that I should be doing. And I want to invite everybody to give more feedback to the podcast that you listen to, because that usually is very gratifying for the one producing it.
It helps stoke the ego.
Yeah. I mean, I used to listen to the Linux Show back when those were the days, and back then there used to be a lot of Mexican podcasts also. Even Miguel de Casa had one, and the podcast brand was not even out there. I mean, there were no iPods back then. There was just MP3 streams, and then you can download from the website. There was no RSS. You can just go there and download your from the archives, and that was the way they used to do things. There was a whole community here in Mexico having this big account on Live 365, and they all talk about open source. You had the OpenBSD show, the Linux show, the Debian show, and so on. And it's kind of sad that it's no longer out there. I mean, they kind of shy away. And actually, it was interesting because they shy away back when there was a legislation to block online broadcasters. And I just recently was listening to Net at Night, and it seems that it's going again. It's going on again and trying to block all these online radio podcasters. Not podcasters, but the broadcasters.
It's the radio. The internet
Pandora
radio.
And Last FM and all those websites. There are more music and copyright.
Yeah, the music
material,
ones, right? Yep.
Right.
It's all about royalties. They want to get higher royalty rates out of the online people.
Right, but then again, I mean, it will affect other non-copyrighted things like talk show, for example. So I think it's a very big bill that needs to be blocked, and it's just 12 days to get that bill blocked. So I think it's a very big issue on online media.
Is that John who just jumped in?
Yep, I'm here.
Hey, John, how are you?
Good. How's it going, Pat?
Good, good. We're just talking to Alexandro. We'll get to you in a sec, okay?
All right. I had a question for Alexandro, actually.
Shoot, go ahead.
Sure.
Yeah, I was in ABI Source, Pound ABI Source, a few weeks ago, and I was curious why ABI Word hadn't adopted open document format standard yet. It's still kind of crappy. You know, it can't really save it. So I asked a couple of developers, and as they explained it, it's sort of difficult to implement it, and they have to do a lot of restructuring of how the internals of their application work and make it mirror how OpenOffice works. And I was curious what Alexandro had to say about that.
I actually talked to the guys back when Open Documents was new, and basically what they say is they don't have the resources. There was a plugin back when there was OpenOffice format. I think that plugin got migrated to Open Documents, but you have to get it separately. And it's actually in the repositories, as far as I know. I think I saw AbiWord-ODF, and it's a plugin to transform to Open Documents. But the plugin is also not very well implemented. So I guess the only answer is, well, they need more developers to implement the whole scheme. It's not very difficult. I don't know how difficult is the API of AbiWord, but I don't think it's that much because it's also based on XML from what I think. And they actually work with HTML. So, I mean, you can save it as HTML. So saving it to a different XML scheme shouldn't be that much of a problem. I guess
right.
You have to ask them. Yeah.
They had it 85% implemented, and the last 15% was difficult. They have to do some serious surgery on the application, and I guess they just don't have the resources. Google, though, was
right.
able to implement ODF in a week, right?
Well, like I said, Google didn't implement it. They bought the company that got it implemented. And like I said before, that company got it implemented within a week. So then again, the support is not that great. I mean, from what I know, it's about 70%. Like if you actually work with spreadsheets in Open Document and save it in Open Office and upload and back and forth on all these different features, you will find that it's around 70% implemented, but it's workable.
Alexandro, you're really into the Python programming. You've taken a big lead with the little study group that we've organized on the forum and on the wiki. Why are you so much into Python? What is it about Python that gets you interested?
Well, Python is programming for the people. I mean, it's like, it's really easy to, it's very language-like. Python was created by Guido van Rossum, and Guido is a linguist. I think he is. I don't know if it was Guido or it was Mako, now that I think about it. But anyway, I remember they used to say Perl is like English and Python is like French, because in the French language you cannot really modify the sentence that well. So it would just be one standard way. And developing in Python, it creates those standards and implement it into the programming language. And you cannot really move that much around, making the language easy to communicate to other developers. In other words, if I send you a Python program, even if you don't understand or have learned Python before, you can see the logic of what it's doing or what it's trying to get implemented. While in Perl, there is no north, south, east, west, which is usually an advantage because a lot of the Perl developers get to develop things rather quickly without many hassles, like getting indentation right. But on the flip side, it's very complex to be able to be read by somebody else. It's usually, if you don't have it thoroughly commented, within a week, you will forget what you wrote. And only you and God will know, and within a year, only God know, and then I think you're exaggerating God's ability to remember Perl. So, yeah.
Hardcore Perl guys, you know, they love Perl. They think it's the greatest thing ever invented. You know,
yeah, because it's flexible.
I know, It's very flexible. It's very powerful. I look at Perl scripts and, you know, I go cross-eyed after about 15, 20 minutes looking at that code. It gets a little tedious. That's, you know, just my opinion.
Yeah. And I really don't want to bash Perl that much, even though I bash it thoroughly. But really it's not because, as far as I, as a language go, it's not Perl, it's actually Java. I mean, Java has a very complex dependency tree. And getting people to learn Java, getting people to learn C++ is very, very tedious. And I think Python is a rather simpler language for people to grasp, and because of the flexibility of it, is also, actually Python right now is, you can arguably speak, because the Python modules repositories is growing a lot, and you get Python almost in everywhere. It's becoming the lingua franca of open source. You can code Python for the GIMP, you can code Python for Blender, you can code Python for GTK, for Qt, for WX widgets, and it's becoming such a flexible language that because it's getting implemented everywhere, that I think is pretty much a language of the future. Now that sounds very very marketing-like, but I think because it's easy to learn and because it's getting very flexible, it's just the best choice right now. I mean, you can argue that Ruby right now is the thing, but Ruby is not Rails, and Rails is the thing that is happening. So not many people actually know Ruby. They know Rails, but Ruby is not really that popular as opposed to Python.
It's good because it's object-oriented, and it's not too difficult to grasp the basic concepts of it.
Right, yeah. And I mean, I know I love other languages. I love PHP. I think PHP rocks, even though a lot of people bash it. And it's funny because they bash PHP and MySQL on their blogs that run PHP and MySQL. So it's like I wouldn't touch PHP with a stick on their WordPress blog. So yeah, it's funny.
So wait, did you say you liked PHP or you wouldn't touch it with a stick?
No, a lot of people bash PHP,
okay.
and they say they wouldn't touch it with a stick, and they say it on a PHP-based blog.
Yeah, okay, I got it. Yeah. Well, that's to be expected, because people are usually consistent like that.
Windows users.
Yeah. There's a PHP podcast that I listen to. What a surprise, right? It's called PHP Pro. And the guys are lazy. They don't put that many shows out there, but the shows that they actually come to put out, they're actually very interested because they give you insight on the PHP sphere, development sphere, and they talk a lot about PHP things going on in the latest, PHP 6 being implemented, some Unicode, and trying to make the language more secure, and what is the actual problem with security on PHP, and so, there's a lot of things going on. I think SEND just renewed their certification scheme, so actually the new SEND certification is actually much more or much better targeted to the PHP developers. So there's a lot of good things going on in PHP at the moment. It's just that PHP usually has got caught on in the thing that PHP is just for the web, which you can argue right now because you have command line interfaces for PHP, you have PHP GTK, but there is not that much development going on there as opposed to Python, for example.
Python is the shit.
Yeah.
Well, you're just saying that because you started that forum.
Yeah, they did. They hired Guido. They hired him.
Right. Must be important to them.
Yeah, they're hiring everybody, Google.
Yeah. They didn't hire me, though.
Anybody that matters.
Not yet.
They didn't hire me either. They didn't hire me either. Oh, don't worry.
It's a matter of time. I sent my submission to the Google office in New York. They wanted some Linux sysadmin or something.
I figure you'd be for the Google office in Mexico.
No, man. I'm trying to get off the country.
California is the main one, right?
Say what?
The main office is in California, no?
Yeah, yeah. They just opened in New York, and actually that's where...
Tokyo is another big one.
Say what?
Tokyo is another big office they have.
Yeah,
I think
UK
is pretty
big.
They have one in India, too.
How do you know? They have one in Mexico, actually, and they have one in Argentina. But I'm not sure where that is. I've never actually seen it. And I don't know anybody that works there. Which is weird. Yeah. So by now, some of the source guy would have been hired in Google Mexico or something.
Alexander, one quick question for you. What distro do you run and why?
I use Mandriva. And I say it proudly because actually I don't change that much my infrastructure. I learned Linux with Mandriva and I never switch. Actually, it was called Mandrake or Mandrake, how we call it in Spanish and in French. So basically I adopted it, I used it, I broke it, and I rebuild it, and I actually run with it. I mean, I know a lot of distro hoppers out there, and I'm just not one of them. I like to stick to things until it worked, and once they work, I usually stay there. And that usually brought me to the Mandriva community, which itself gave me a big network of Mandriva users. So why switch? I already have my body list full of Mandriva users that know anything about everything. And so I don't really need to. I mean, I have a whole lot of knowledge already on my body list, I guess. Away from that, I think Mandriva had it right. I mean, I think it was the Ubuntu before Ubuntu, but they got a lot of also Linkspire bad rap, in the sense that Mandriva was easy, and that was their downfall. For example, back in the days, you actually installed Debian. That's hardcore. And I know you guys know that. I mean, you use Slackware a lot, and it's usually because why you use Slackware? Because of geek rights, right? You want to have the geek lead rights.
Maybe 7 years ago. Years ago, not so much now.
Right. But then again, it was the hardcore distros back there. So, and even now, a lot of people say if you really want to learn how Linux works, you should put, right now, actually, that flag has been passed around. A lot of people say Gentoo, a lot of people say Slackware. But then again, Debian used to be very difficult back in 2001, and now Debian is very simple, and Ubuntu make it even more simple. But then again, it's funny because, well, you're loving Ubuntu because it's simple, yet you hated Mandriva because it was simple. So it was kind of, I don't get it. Also, they say about the repositories, the RPM-based. I know I went into RPM hell my first time. I learned, and I never went back to it. I mean, I never had RPM hell once I learned that the Cooker repository in Mandriva was the testing repository and what testing actually meant. I guess newbies will say, oh, I will go to a website, download the RPM, try to run it, and then it will get into RPM hell. So, I don't know, I just never went there, and I never experienced RPM hell again.
RPMs have gotten a lot better. I mean, back in the day, you would get more of that RPM hell. Like, back in, like, we're talking, like, Red Hat 4, 5, 6. Back then, it was more prevalent. Not so much now, though.
Well, but one of the things of RPM hell was that you will see an RPM build for Red Hat, and then you want to install it in SUS or in Mandrake or any other RPM-based distro, and then you will get issues because they had different versions and stuff. So I think it was more on the ignorance of the user than on the actual, well, why they got into it. Then again, I do use Gentoo, and I do use other distros. I have Debian on my Nokia 770 and my Nokia 800, and they run fine. And I have Puppy Linux running on this small device, embedded device that I have. And I have another box back home running it is Ubuntu. I switched it, so I couldn't remember. And, I use a lot of distros, but I like Mandriva because, well, I have all this knowledge. I'm not going to just hop out of it. So, yeah.
So what you're saying is Pat ended up in RPM hell because he was ignorant.
Yeah. Young, dumb, full of, yeah.
Full of pride.
It's because I wanted to install something not in the official repository.
Yeah. But actually, the repositories in Mandriva, they're huge. I mean, I have actually got into applications that are really cool, and I just didn't have any idea that they were on Linux. I just had this Terminator X program a couple of days ago. It's actually a scratching simulation software. So you will actually use it like a turntable and get mixes of all these samples and then build your own mix. And that's actually quite funny. There is all these obscure applications and nobody talks about it. And when you discover them, it's like, wow, this is really cool. And I know you guys are all into that Linux media thing. I mean, you've been looking for that... the video editing and the sound mixing and all that.
What was the name of that application?
Terminator X. Actually, I met the program using Dynabolics, which I know you guys use. So you've probably seen it, just haven't played that much with it, I guess. So, yeah.
Cool.
And it's easy. I just put your PMI Terminator X and boom, it's there. Also, it's funny, here in Guadalajara, there's the local Linux user group. They are very Mandriva based. I mean, they even have they have a server with all the distributions so you can just come in and FTP to the box and get all the packages in LAN speed. So LAN speed is great. I mean, there's a lot of Ubuntu users, but yeah, just different flavors of users, I guess.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when I first tried using Mandrake way back in the day, and it was kind of after I got out of the Red Hat phase. And I don't know. It was a nice distribution, but it didn't grab me. Not that it was bad. It's just
I just wrote them, and I really want to bring this up, guys, because I really want to get your input on it. I usually think a lot of technology as a technologist, like what will be the next wave and things, kind of like you guys on your show. And I sent an email to Mandriva, and I was surprised they actually got back to me that fast. They got back to me in a couple of hours from that email. I was proposing... Well, basically, you see Apple with the .Mac, you see Windows Vista, Microsoft with their Live, and Google, their speculations about their OS. And I think right now, in the Web 2.0 base, I think desktop should be more web-aware. Not just internet applications, just the whole desktop more web-aware, more web-friendly. So, for example, you will get services. Right now, for example, you have, right now the Mac is actually the one that I have implemented the best, but not as good as it could be. With the iPod Music Store, iTunes Music Store and the iPod, they actually do a vertical integrated experience that go from the web, from the music store, to the box, to the device. and it's all synced and they sold that way. The same way they did with .NET when you have your, I mean, it's pricey, I know, but the point there is that they sold the idea of this vertically integrated that goes beyond your box. And I think on Linux, we have all this technology available, and even the core technology underlying all these services, we're just not using them. We're not making these projects talk to each other. So, for example, a distro might be a very good way to, for example, let's say X distro, I mean, not any specific, but say the new version of X distro will come out, and once you install it in your application, you will actually create your user and your password, and it will be distributed across all these open source software, which could be game, IRC, so you build this, you will auto-generate your GPG signature, and then you get all these, do you want to sign up for this web X distro account, which will provide a blog, which will provide web dev, G-disk-type service where you can easily upload your content to the web, to your website, and you will have all these vertically integrated identity that will go from your desktop to your web browser blog, I mean, to your web blog or web application that you want. I think that it's a great idea, and I think a distro could implement it, but I want to know more opinions on it. I mean, is it a good idea or not? I don't know.
Well, you do see a little bit of integration. You have, like, Amarok, you know, bringing in Magnitude, and I think they were going to do the same thing in Banshee, if I wasn't mistaken. Kind of going along the lines of doing the iTunes kind of thing. You know, but
they're decoupling. I mean, they're different parties working together, which is great. I mean, I'm all for it. But integration will just come to a point, I think. I think
yeah,
they will actually emulate the framework that Mac put on. While if you have something developed in one piece, it will actually have the ability to scale more. I mean, you will more easily implement more features in the stack.
If one party's controlling it from the start to the end, yeah, they could definitely control it.
I mean, think, how would the Google desktop be if it was a Linux distro? What would it have? What do you expect to have? Should it be integrated to GTalk, Blogger, and all these services? No doubt. So, I mean, creating web applications is not really that hard, so why not a distro going the other way and created the whole Google experience using open standards and then open source the whole stack so people can put their WordPress and the WordPress would automatically talk because it will create the bindings to talk to their desktop. So you can just blog from your desktop or blog from your mobile and then just automatically sync using XML RPC, for example, or some other technology out there. And I think that will be a good future, but then again, hey, it's just people. We need the idea and we need the people. Code is the currency.
It's tough. It's going to take somebody to step up and take the initiative to do something like that. You know,
yeah.
From the commercial side.
So I sent that email to Mandriva saying all those things, and they actually say, you know what, we actually been thinking about that, and they actually responded. They were pretty open. Would you want to be part of the development or at least some part of the project if we actually come to accept it? And I was surprised because that whole conversation took about 5 hours. I mean, a couple hours to get that email, send that email right back. They answered me the same day.
Well, at least they're responsive. Give them that much.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to finally talk to you, Alexandro. It's good to talk to you. You've been around for a long time, and it's actually really nice to actually speak to you in person. Or at least
great.
Through Asterisk.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, you're more than welcome to stick around to the end. We only got a few more minutes, so I just wanted to talk to John for a few minutes. John, you still
sure.
around?
Yeah, I'm still here.
What's going on, John? How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
John, what's your name on the IRC so everybody knows who you are?
I am Unstable, which shows that I use Debian Unstable.
Cool. Where are you from? Where are you calling in from, John?
I am from New York. I'm part of Long Island GNU / Linux Users Group, LILUG. We meet at Farmingdale College.
That's a pretty big group, isn't it?
Yeah, we're decent size. We get about 50 or 60 guys every month. Been meeting almost 10 years, I think 9 years now. So, yeah, decent size. We just got our not-for-profit status through the state, so, yeah.
Was that difficult to do?
I didn't do it, but from what I hear, yeah, it's, you know, you go through the bureaucracy machine, and, a lot of paperwork, and that's just being incorporated through the state. Then you, if you want to be 501c3, which is national not-for-profit, then that's all more paperwork, so we're doing that now, hopefully, so we can get some donations and things like that and make it easier for people to donate to the group.
Cool. How long have you been listening to the show?
About a year. Probably I've been listening to the show. I just jumped into the IRC channel because we're going to do a show out on the island, a radio show, over the air. So I thought I would observe and see what's going on.
When's that going to start?
Cool. What?
It's through WUSB. It's University of Stony Brook. We didn't start the show yet. It'll probably start in a week. We don't really know what we're going to do, you know.
Stony Brook, like, is it?
Yes, yeah, Stony
Brook. Are they still stony out there?
Yeah, they're still stony out there.
Is it going to be a Linux or open source based show?
Oh, yeah, it's going to be free software based, of course, you know. It'll be probably guys from LILUG doing the show.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you know, we figured why not? Let's just do it and see how it goes. And so, kind of like you guys did.
Just jump right into it.
Exactly.
Drink lots of beer before you start talking. It usually helps.
I'll keep that in mind.
Make sure you have a couple people. If it's just one person, it's really hard to do.
Oh, yeah.
We have a few people. So I guess, I don't know. None of us are really that funny. You know, LUG Radio's got the hilarious thing going, and they got the accents, and you guys have your own style. You guys seem to have really good people that come onto the show, and, you know, good interviews every show, so maybe we'll get something unique and bring something to the community that people like to listen to. But right now, you know, we don't know what we're going to do, so it's all up in the air, and it could change into anything.
No,
or I could just miserably fail, and we'll stop doing
Is that going to be weekly?
We don't know. It all depends. The radio show is fairly busy, so, you know, the station director will tell us what slot we can get in and when. And I guess we'll do a, you know, broadcast over the air, so people in the New York area, I'm not sure what the radius is of the show, but people in the area and then people over the web can listen. And, you know, we'll set up maybe an asterisk box and make it easier for people to call in and things like that.
Cool, man. Let us know, man. We'll put you on the whole Linux show podcast that Dan maintains.
Maybe we'll interview you guys first for our first show.
Just as long as it's not 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm good.
Okay. Well, you guys are what state are you in?
We're in PA.
Virginia.
PA? Oh, so you guys are East Coast.
Yeah,
it won't
we're
be
East
3
Coast.
In the morning. It'll be sometime in the day or the evening.
That's cool.
Yep. What LUG do you guys go to out in PA?
Well, Dan and Link founded the Lehigh Valley Linux User Group here.
Oh, okay.
I'm in Virginia, so we have the Tidewater Unix Users Group down here. So. And now Link's going to be in Philly, right? Or close to Philly.
That's what he said, yeah. He's switching jobs, moving closer to Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Was good stuff, man.
Yeah, anything else for tonight?
I'm good, man.
How far are you guys from Philly?
We're like 70 miles.
Six hours?
65. No, not that far.
I'm 5 hours.
Like an hour and change.
I went to high school in Philly, and it was pretty cool. Is that far from Bethlehem, though? I thought it was closer.
It's probably good. I'm 60 confused. Miles, I'd say. 60 miles there?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about, on a good day, you could do it in about an hour, if that, if you don't hit a lot of traffic. Right up the, well, you know what, it's about half an hour up the turnpike, another half, 15, 20 minutes, it's about an hour.
It's an hour.
To get to Center City, Philly, if you don't hit traffic.
Yeah.
That's the big if.
You go 3 o'clock in the morning, you won't hit traffic.
Right. All right.
We're like 100 miles west of New York City.
Cool. Yeah. I think it's open country in PA. PA is a weird, it's very urban on the east side. It's very country on the west side.
It is.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It's very rural throughout the middle.
Yeah. Well, the middle is basically a big cornfield.
Yeah.
And State College, which is, Penn State, which is huge.
Yeah, I'm going to State College this weekend, actually.
Yeah, it's a humongous school.
What are you going there for? Just hang out?
Girlfriend's sister-in-law's wedding.
Oh.
Like what time does the log over there meet? I don't have good timing, do I?
I have no idea.
Penn State's far away from here. Penn State's right in the middle of the state. It's pretty far away.
It's a 3-hour drive.
Yeah.
3 hours.
You can give Andrew Krause goes to Penn State. You can give him a shout out.
Who?
Andrew Krause, the guy who wrote the GTK book. We had.
Okay, yeah, that was last week, wasn't it?
Was it last week?
Oh, let me look at the calendar.
It's all a blur at this point. Now we
no,
we
that
had
was Lance Davis. West. Yeah, Andrew Krause.
Yeah, we had to send the West
ago.
Guys on last year, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Guy, thanks for talking to us. It's been real, man. Good stuff.
Cool.
Alexandro, keep up the good work, man. Open office, good project. You're pretty active on the bulletin board and the IRC, and we appreciate it, man.
And John, you keep up the good work.
Yeah, I'm trying to get the Python learning group going on now.
Good stuff.
Hope we can get it together.
Yeah, I'm trying to learn some Python myself, man. I love to learn Python if I can. It's a little difficult, but I'll try.
Cool. Riddlebox, I've been doing a project, actually. I think it's an address book. He already had it, and he's trying to port it to a GTK interface. It's actually quite good work what he have done so far. We just have to break down the code and explain it to the rest of us so we can actually learn it.
Yeah. John, thank you. Too, and I look forward to listening to your show.
Yep. Yeah. Keep in touch, man. Let us know how it goes, man.
Right. If I need some advice or if I need somebody to interview, I'll ask you guys.
We'll go.
Be our first show. Yeah. Just glad to contribute to the community. You know, have another show on there. Talk about free
definitely.
Software.
Look forward to
word,
it.
You know, we all
more the merrier, man. Yep. Absolutely. Dan, you going to play some music tonight?
Yeah, we got the MC Plus.
Yeah, MC Plus Plus, man.
Antics.
This is a good song, man. I really like this guy. Check this out. This is MC Plus Plus. The name of the song is called Antsky Antics.
Yep, and thank you guys, everybody, for coming on. We'll see you next week.
Good night.
Good night.
I'm the ace analyzing ASCII algorithms, all architectures allow me to get with them. Antivirus agents aren't able to anesthetize acidic apps that I cause to arise. You better back up your bytes and beef up your buffers before bugs in your browser breach your barriers like butter. Corrupting with CMOS, causing cores to corrode, prepping crypto in CCB mode, clearing out the cache, calling CPU commands, downloading data, dissing DRM demands, dancing in the dark with digital demons, directing DOS while your defenders are dreaming. Every email's examined with ease. Even experts can't escape my EXEs as each effortlessly expands my empire, filling up files faster than Firewire. Foolish fat fucks frequently flame me. Forensic flatfoots fail to frame me. Groupies Google me to get gigs of gifts, giving graphic guarantees that I shoot the gift. Going for the gold, I'm the gigahertz gangster. I hurt hard drive by some hardware handlers. How many home pages have I hacked? When your HP hangs, don't have a heart attack. Intel's infrastructure is inherently inferior to the intellect that illumines the interior of the inner sanctum where I like to interface, jotting down Java that jostles jackanapes. Journaling just might save your jazz drive when I jack the jewels, keeping your junk alive. Killer apps keep knocking, like Kris Kringle, kleptomaniacs biting, like craft singles. All the kids know that I kick it with Kern again. Let me lay claim to the lessons you should learn again. Blame the calculus, lashes, losers who ain't proud. I'm not the Lord of Linux, I'm laughing out loud. I melt malicious machines, like margarine, meaning list morons get moved to the margins. Music murders, monopolies like Microsoft. Nothing's what I need to get nasty as Nabokov. Never negotiate with narrowband news, making numerous networks of NANDs and nanotubes. Obfuscating object, codes an obligation to orchestrate my opponent's obliteration. Overall, it's obvious that open source gets owned by proprietary programs, and my processor is prone to produce and precipitate your packet getting perforated. No patch prevents piracy I've perpetrated. Word accused of queries in quantity, quit quoting quatrains of questionable quality. Quatrice quell your quandaries quadratically. Real-time research revises rules radically. RSA and Rindell won't repel my raids, and your router won't refuse the packet I've replaced. My SSID has no static on its signal. My static IP safeguarded by a sentinel. Screw with my server and I'll serve you a smack up by 10 tons of terabytes. All my tape backup with TCP technology. I threaten terror, tricking terminal through type 2 error. I upload Unix passwords using utilities like USB. I have ubiquitous abilities, unprotected, unzipping in UDMA. Van Eck freaking videos via VGA. My voice is a vehicle for virtual venom. I view vulnerabilities and then vibe with them. With Wi-Fi my WAN wickedly wires words. The World Wide Web gets wrecked with worms. When will you know my work's not WYSIWYG? Extreme like X-Ray when I plot like XFIG. 86 when Xenu gets rocked. Execution is for those who Z rocks. You're yodeling from yonder and away, yet you made no yen since Y2K. You yearn for success like that of Yahoo, but your zombie processes could fill up a zoo. Your zero knowledge proofs are flawed like Zionism. I'm in the zone like Zeus, hot like Hebrajism.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.
That's it for this week.